Good evening. I would like to thank all of you for coming to tonight's lecture as a part of our three-year Templeton Research Lecture Series on the constructive engagement of science and religion. My name is Jim Proctor. I'm a faculty member at UC Santa Barbara in the Department of Geography. Our program, which we have entitled Science, Religion, and the Human Experience, seeks to shed scholarly light on the ways that science and religion are embedded in, yet seek to transcend, the historical, political, psychological, and other contexts defining the human experience. Further information on our program and remaining lectures, we have two coming up in early April and two coming up in early May, may be found on the tables in the back or on our website, which is listed on the brochures. You may also obtain the text of the lecture and the comments from tonight and last night's lecture online soon, within the week, and video as well, within several weeks. Some of you were with us last night at Corwin Pavilion. Last night and tonight we have been quite fortunate to feature two world-class scholars whose areas of research perhaps in different ways address one of the most well-known and controversial topics in science-religion dialogue, at least in the United States, and that, of course, is Darwinian evolution. Last night, some of you were with us to hear Michael Ruse, who holds an endowed chair in philosophy at Florida State. His title was Darwinism and Atheism, A Marriage Made in Heaven. Well, tonight we are very pleased to feature Bruce Tiffany, our own UCSB professor of geological sciences, who follows up with a talk with a similar title, The Origins of Science and Religion, or Parents and Offspring Should Respect Each Other. So family and marriage has been the primary theme for these two evenings. We are grateful that Professors Ruse and Tiffany have agreed to serve as discussants. We will have Professor Ruse offering comments on Professor Tiffany's talk immediately after. And secondly, Professor Porter Abbott of our Department of English will also provide comments on the talk. Now, we are sure that you would like to ask questions, and I'd strongly urge you to do so. The way we do this is we distribute index cards and little pencils if you need them. You can take one and write legibly enough so that I may read it, and I will read as many questions as I can in the question and answer period that follows the discussant's comments. Now I have the pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Bruce Tiffany. And I suppose I'm supposed to do a formal introduction, and so I will at least attempt one. Bruce Tiffany is, again, a faculty member, a professor in our Department of Geological Sciences, having arrived here in 1986. His PhD from Harvard is in paleobotany. His work primarily is in paleobotany and a bunch of technical terms which neither you nor I would make much sense of, angiosperm neocarpology, and so forth. I won't go on. But Bruce does highly impressive work mixing his long-term love of plants with geology through paleobotany. He is a member of several important societies, and the other day he was asked to volunteer this list. I think it's a bit longer than you have here on your website, the Geological Society of America, Botanical Society of America, International Organization for Paleobotany, International Organization, I'm sorry, Association of Wood Anatomists, and so forth. He has an impressive list of publications in the same area, and he not only holds academic honors, such as being a fellow for the Geological Society of America, but has obtained honors at several institutions, including UC Santa Barbara, for excellence in teaching. Bruce is a very effective and yet somewhat controversial teacher. And I think the reason is because how he thinks of himself and his work. And I'd like to read briefly a self-description from his website. I believe that facts and theories are inseparable, and thus my research embraces both classical descriptive systematics based on anatomy and morphology and the establishment of broader, more speculative hypotheses. I think what Bruce is alluding to is that he has spent a great deal of time reading on the nature of science and also reading on the nature of science and religion in science. And although Bruce, of course, made the typical apology of, well, I'm only a scientist, why would you ever invite me to talk? My committee knew a long time ago that we wanted Bruce to come and share his insights as an historically and philosophically informed geological scientist on the nature of science and religion. And that is what he will do tonight. So without further ado, let me welcome Bruce Tiffany.
You know, I do rather feel like a fish out of water in this particular series, in part because all of the other individuals who have come before the Templeton-Leitcher sequence have been individuals who have been directly concerned with the questions of science and religion in society, as studying it from one perspective or another. Our speaker of last night, who was absolutely fascinating and taught me a very great deal, by example, being a philosopher and historian of science, previous individuals working on the questions of cognition. I'm just a silly little student of very dead plants. But on the other hand, perhaps it serves, I will serve as something of an example, because there are a tremendous number of people, I suspect, like myself, who are out there who are technically scientists, who practice science, who would be described as scientists and understood as such in the sort of public imagery, who came into science very much the same way that I did. Not because we suddenly understood and somehow loved science, but because we understood and loved some aspect of the natural world. And in some respects, I could not avoid becoming a botanist with a PhD, because both of my parents had PhDs in botany. My brother had a PhD in botany. And if I'm going to deal with anything in the way of dinnertime conversation, I was going to have to go get a PhD in botany. And I was certainly well on my way to doing that, undergraduate major in biology. Happened to chance across, and this is for the undergraduates a kindly word of advice, by chance came across a geology course, which I had no idea what geology was about until I took the course, and all of a sudden I said, hey, wow, this stuff is just as much fun as plants. Hey, how can I do plants and geology at the same time? Fossil plants. So I ended up being all but a double major, missing only by organic chemistry, graduated as a geology major, came back and got my PhD ultimately in botany and went off to study fossil plants. And I was, I think, a good 5 or 6 years into being a young assistant professor when the questions of a couple of graduate students to me made me begin to realize, you know, I'm a scientist, but what's that? What's science? How did I get into this? Yeah, I know, because I love plants, but what's the technology, what's the technique, what's the philosophy of this subject that I am practicing? I know my plants, but I do not necessarily know what science is. I was chased into this also by the fact that students would start to ask questions of me and, in essence, ask me to defend a particular scientific fact. You know, how did you gain that? How do you know that that is so? Why would you insist that I memorize it for the exam? And you know, at some point, you begin to doubt yourself when you consistently hear a little voice saying, because I said so and I learned it. And I came to the conclusion that it was perhaps time that I turned around myself to figure out how we know what we know as versus what we know. Because if I am going to present it to a student, I should be able to give them that perception of how we know as well as what we know, and therefore, as it were, defend myself and defend more properly the facts that I am presenting. Certainly, some of the tougher of those questions came from students who were seriously interested in religion and had a religious background and were asking me to distinguish between science and their beliefs based upon religion. And why should I insist or suggest that they know in this course the materials and findings of science rather than accept some other hypotheses in religion? And of course, being a paleontologist is to be an evolutionary biologist, so color me lightning rod. This was a question that would come up very frequently. And the more that I thought about this and realized, the more I began to get interested in the evolution-creation debate, and I certainly was initially introduced to it in the sense of a polarized debate, in the sense of simple-minded answers like this, religions offer unquestioned answers, science offers unanswered questions. We get even more deeply into it, and we know the evil EVIL, evolution cretinism debates that go on, and each side sees the other as such. So that these kinds of questions rose in my mind that there was, you know, something here that was a great import, that scientists, and I as a scientist, were not doing a particularly good job of communicating what science was. As a matter of fact, most scientists were not very interested at all. They just simply wanted to get on with doing science without necessarily thinking about it. So that led me ultimately to decide that this was something very important. Important enough now that when I teach my large general education courses, I devote a substantial portion, like about 20%, not to the actual information that I am supposed to, fossils and whatnot, but to talk about how we got that information, why we can trust that information in the context of science, and why this is important to the student. That this is a very important aspect of what we should be doing as scientists. And in the context of the Templeton talks, or the Templeton lectures on the intercreative interaction between science and religion, one of the points that I want to come forward and make very clearly is that scientists should be explaining themselves much more clearly to the rest of the populace, including those with religious beliefs, and that if they do so with full knowledge of what science really is and can do and cannot do, because many scientists do not recognize what science cannot do, that we will come to, I think, a more civil and properly cultured understanding of this debate. So what I want to do today is give you a brief exploration, first, of the nature of science and of religion. Then I want to suggest to you that one of the more surprising aspects of this is that if one looks into this in historical sense, one will discover that the processes and the way of thinking that we will call in the present-day science, which I will initially term the mode of research knowledge, really arose directly out of the Christian church. And in one sense, or Judeo-Christian tradition, I should say, to be a bit more accurate. And in one sense, therefore, it is completely silly that there is this argument going on between evolution, in particular, with Protestant forms of Christianity in North America, in particular, in the present day. I'm going to suggest that the mode in which this arose actually parallels a biological feature, biological process, that has been described as exaptation. Exaptation. Wake up, little machine. Thank you. Exaptation is the process whereby a feature that evolved for one purpose, ultimately in the process of its development, as it were, crossed the trajectory of a much more important adaptive process, adaptive feature. For example, if we look at the origin of birds, one of the puzzles is how do birds come to develop feathers in flight? And, you know, a half-feathered bird is probably going to be a pretty clumsy little character, and so to say that a bird knew it wanted to learn how to fly, and it went through a series of intermediate stages, it's probably going to get taken out by a predator while it's fumbling around, and it's going to be a very poor bird before it gets off the ground. But an alternative suggestion is that instead of thinking of feathers as just for flight, what if feathers are for insulation? And we increasingly are finding evidence that feathers are not a unique characteristic of birds, but that indeed feathers probably have turned up several times within the evolutionary history of reptiles. And therefore, an alternative hypothesis would be that you get a really small reptile, and by the way, notice that birds are very small reptiles by and large, you get a really small reptile, it's got a thermoregulation problem. One way to deal with that is to put on some insulation. One of the best forms of insulation is feathers. Feathers arise very neatly from scales. It's quite clear that's an easy developmental change. So therefore, we start off with a bunch of little feathered dinosaurs that are staying warm in their down coats running around. And at some point, evolution, natural selection comes along, and these characters, when they fall out of trees, fall more slowly because they've got greater surface area, and then they learn how to steer themselves, and we're off and running. An exaptation, then, we start off with a characteristic for one purpose, feathers for insulation, and it turns to a second purpose, feathers for flight. Or, for example, a little characteristic that all of us in this room, unless somebody has an ancestry they would like to discuss in private later, that we all carry around with us is a three-boned middle ear. The three-boned middle ear allows us to hear somewhat more effectively at higher ranges, higher pitches of sound. It is derived from an exaptation because in the primitive forms of our ancestors, mammal-like reptiles, so-called, the lower jaw was made up of many bones, including a bunch of little guys back here at the back end of the jaw. And if you check yourself out, you will find that your lower jaw consists of two bones that are fused in the center, one on either side. One of the characteristics of mammals is that they have a single lower jaw. The leftover bits and pieces back here, specifically the articular and quadrate bones, got transferred into the middle ear, and we end up with a three-boned middle ear. Again, what we're dealing with then is a set of characteristics that are part of the jaw function to begin with that ultimately get picked up by the fiddling, tinkering of natural selection and evolution, and we end up with a, as one poet once had it, a jaw full of our an earful of our ancestors' jaw. Okay. I would suggest that in a very real sense, science, which we now see as something that is greatly different from religion, arose in a similar manner by the process of exaptation. That initially science was simply a way within the Christian tradition of better knowing God's creative works of the natural world, which over a period of time, as it evolved and developed its powers, ultimately became, as it were, separate from its original theological basis and has gone off and taken on a life of its own. But in taking on that life of its own in a different way of knowing, as it were, we can, if we want to, turn around and say that it is opposed to the Christian tradition that it arose in. But I think that that is potentially contrived, and as I think our speaker of last evening made rather clear, is something that you have to do almost in looking to a political end to arrive at. There is nothing inherent in science that makes it inimical to Christian religion. So I will pursue through and look at first the nature of science versus religion in a very simple-minded manner, and then look at the development of science within the Judeo-Christian tradition, and come up and end with Charles Darwin, about whom we heard a substantial amount on Thursday evening. Let me again say, as was implicit, I think, in the introduction, this is not my field of research. In a very real sense, what I'm doing is I'm giving a rehash of my standard lecture in Geology 30, with a little bit more added on here and there, that this is a summation of the perception that I think is important for students and the public to have. As a general education lecture, it is general. It probably has some errors, because after all, I'm not in my own research field. And that is why there are two guardian angels lurking down here in the dark, otherwise known as commentators, Michael Ruse on the one hand and Porter Abbott on the other, who will come up here and catch me out and then catch me out as necessary and make sure that you do not leave with any wrong pieces of information. Thank you, gentlemen, both, no matter what I throw at you later. Okay. So let us start off and talk about knowledge. What's knowledge? Knowledge is the kind of information that any of us uses to get ourselves through life day by day. The kinds of facts that allow you to function. In some cases, those facts are little things like knowing where the car keys are, where the light switch is, whose turn it is to make breakfast. In other cases, those facts are larger features of sort of aesthetics or religion that make our lives purposeful to ourselves, our lives beautiful to ourselves, our lives present to ourselves. I would suggest that there are two broad categories, and I would repeat from the literature, and I may have chosen a literature that is perhaps not as mainstream as it could be, or I may be mainstream, but I've seen it repeated fairly consistently, so I think I'm not giving you a schism sect perspective on this, that one can look at knowledge as broken into two broad forms, belief knowledge on the one hand and research knowledge on the other hand. Both of these are descriptive terms about how one gathers knowledge and what the nature of that knowledge is. Let me at the outset make it very clear that they are both equally valid and that they can reside, I think, within one human being. Certainly there are lots of people out there who contend, oh, how can you be a scientist and believe, or how can you be a believer and a scientist? Can a Darwinian be a Christian, or a Christian a Darwinian, to use Michael Ruse's book title? That is not a problem to me. Human beings are sufficiently complex, dualistic or multiplistic organisms, and that different ways of knowing can be applied to different aspects within one individual's life. You can be a perfectly functional, good experimental biochemist, and then go home and know that your child loves you. And that is not a contradiction. So let me start with belief knowledge, which would be tied up with a sense of religion, but also things like aesthetics, beauty, etc. Belief knowledge is that category of knowledge about the world that is unique and inherent to each individual. It is something that we gain individually, we defend individually. It is not something that we find easy to describe. I like Beethoven and you like Burt Bacharach. Okay, that's your problem, or maybe that's my problem. But it's something that's deep, that is central to the individual. It's personal. It is by that feature not open to any kind of quantitative test. It's not open to being falsified, to being disproven. You've got it, it's important to you, and nobody else can take it away from you. In a very real sense, we can talk here about the inherent nature, the absolute nature of truth, that something is true or it is false. It is, you know, inherent to each individual. When you have that committee meeting, you come up with one decision. There's no other, you know, it's going to go one way, it's going to go the other way. By very nature of being untestable, unfalsifiable, and inherent to the individual, it is also what we might call supernatural. No, I don't mean October 31st. I mean literally in the proper sense of that term, super nature, above nature. It's not immediately observable out there in the natural world. It is inherent within you. It's a source of great human strength. There's an enormous amount of good that have come out of this in both, again, ethics, artistic creation, religion, etc. So belief knowledge on the one hand. On the second hand is research knowledge. Research knowledge is, in a sense, a recognition of human fallibility, that we make mistakes, that we make errors in our observation. Research knowledge is a group endeavor. It is specifically done in the assumption that there can be universal knowledge that can be shared and agreed upon in some form by two or more human beings. So not individual, group. The minute you get a group, you got a problem because, as you are well aware, if I start the note off here and have it whispered to the other side of the room, it undergoes transmutation as we progress from one side to the other. We know humans are fallible, so we got to figure out one way, to determine that we're going to control for that as best we can do. And that means that there is what we term a research protocol. And the research protocol is simply a mechanism to ensure that we can sort out and determine what is the most probable correct observation, or if we take several observations and try to make an explanation of how the world works out of it, that is, we create a hypothesis, which is simply a description of a process based on two or more observations, two or more data points, we have to sort out between observations and hypotheses and come to a conclusion, come to a common consensus of what we are talking about, what we have seen, and whether or not the hypothesis actually is an effective explanation of what we have seen. So we therefore run into the idea that any fact or hypothesis has got to be repeatable, it's got to be able to be done by more than one human being, because otherwise I can come in here and tell you that I just saw a stegosaurus run down the road, and if nobody else saw it, I can swear all I want to, but that's not going to be scientifically testable. And no, I didn't go over to the brew pub or whatever before giving this talk. So any observation has got to be repeatable, and it's got to be testable, and you've got to be able to prove that it might be wrong. It's got to be falsifiable. Now, as soon as we say all of those things, we mean that we have immediately stuck ourselves not in the supernatural realm, but in the natural realm. We are observing the natural world that any of us, that I can, you know, take 10 of you off into the field tomorrow, we can go dig up fossils, and you can all go see if you see the exact same thing that I do. Looking into my head, 10 people might see 10 very different things, but looking at natural, not supernatural entities, we can all look at the same thing, we can hold it in our hand, we can measure it. And if we can't look at it and measure it directly, we can use instrumentation, perhaps, if it's something very small, a chemical analysis, physical analysis, the scanning electron microscope, etc. Now, as a result of observing the natural world and the fallibility of humans and the fact that humans didn't make the natural world, only God did that, we do not know if our interpretations are ever correct. We only know if we can agree upon the interpretation or the hypothesis that we have in hand. So therefore, there can be nothing in science that is about truth in the absolute sense. You can hear a science say, that is true, that is false. What they are really saying, as far as I am concerned, is that is the most well-tested hypothesis or observation on that particular thing that we are talking about that is generally accepted by science in the present day. It doesn't mean it's absolutely true. It just means it's got, in a sense, the greatest probability. And I would say that science is always about establishing probabilities. In this, I would point out here, as I got jumped on yesterday quite thoroughly by Professor Ruse, that I am being a fairly strict Popperian, which is a philosopher of science, and that there are other views out there, but I find it impossible in my mind to make a distinction that as soon as I say that something is absolutely true in science, how then I can distinguish that from something that is true in religion. So even if the question comes around, you know, is, here we go again, sure, gravity works. Damn, did it again. Anything that we have, any observation that we make has to be open to being tested and falsified. And it may be that gravity will always be so, and that Professor Ruse would say, damn it, man, that's a fact. Now you agree to it? But as soon as we call anything a fact, then the question is, what's not a fact? Is evolution not a fact? Ooh, is natural selection not a fact? We're on a slippery road. Further, and perhaps more importantly, who knows what we're ever going to find in the future? When I was a wee laddie back in my undergraduate days, oh boy, it's getting sad. Continents were stable. They didn't move. And that was absolute fact. You'd be a fool to think a continent could move. I mean, solid as a rock was something much more than a metaphor. And now look at us, and who would have predicted that? Well, a little bit, I got to grant, it's a slightly slippery example, because if you know a little bit about the history of science, sure, that idea was certainly on the order of 60 years old when I was first hearing about continental drift. But there are other features where it is always surprising that you think you've got the answer, and science has got it nailed down. The next thing you do, you turn around, and it's been blown up again. I was greatly amused to open my Scientific American in January this month, and of course, you know, Scientific American, that's supposed to be the cat's meow, this is what we really got down, and reading on the early history of the universe, and it says that there is a long period in the early history of the universe in which no suns or solar systems or galaxies formed. About a day later, I hear on the news the Hubble telescope has picked up a whole bunch of galaxies nobody ever saw before that occurred within the first, I forget what it was, 500 million years of the universe, or in other words, another hypothesis out the window. This is the point of science, that you have to accept things as probable given the particular data that are available to you in the present day and understand that those may change at some point in the future. Now, one might argue that research knowledge and belief knowledge should not cross each other. Indeed, I would say that as soon as you start to use belief inside of research, then you can believe anything you want to believe, and the whole process of testing goes out the window. So there is, in a sense, a clear separation there that should be maintained. On the other hand, to say that the two are absolutely independent would be incorrect for two reasons. First, belief knowledge versus research knowledge. Two ways of gaining the information by which you will work with the world. You have to make a belief choice to decide to use research knowledge. That is something that you start off with. If you are a scientist, you decide, I am going to use this particular technology. That is a belief choice that it is important to you to do so. Once you've made that choice, you are locked into it, and you stay there and you play by the games, okay? Play the game by the rules, okay? But that is a choice for you, and some people do not see that approach as important. That they find that belief knowledge is much more of an important way of dealing with the world for them. And many people, again, as I say, can work in both a belief knowledge and a research knowledge protocol, depending on the particular interaction with the world that they are having. The second thing that I would observe is that the only way that research knowledge is going to function and be successful is if its practitioners are truthful. If they tell exactly what they saw, if they tell everything that they know about the subject, warts and all, features that agree with their hypothesis, features that do not agree with their hypothesis. Truth is absolutely central in this undertaking, and truth is not a research knowledge value. Truth is a belief knowledge value. So there are at least two places, and perhaps more, where the two definitely overlap, and in that sense, perhaps this is a mildly false dichotomy, but it's a real dichotomy in terms of how we go out, particularly in using science and test. So they're not mutually exclusive in a human, and you couldn't have research knowledge without belief knowledge to underpin it, at least in the aspect of truth. Both generate things we call facts. A fact in belief knowledge is defended by the spirit with which the individual wishes to defend it, or if it's a nation, with the strength of their armies. Look at what religion has done in religious wars, and that's arguing for belief knowledge facts. Let us stick, I think, to a temperate and intellectual debate on this. Let's not go any further with that one. Research knowledge, on the other hand, generates facts, and the research knowledge is defended only by the methodology of research. Pink elephants, well, there may be some out there. We can go run some tests. That's probably a very weakly defended hypothesis or very weakly defended observation. We can go and test it and get rid of it. Other hypotheses that have withstood repeated testing can perhaps be elevated in the usual routine hypothesis theory law, can be elevated to a theory or to a law, but all that is saying is that they have withstood repeated testing and falsification, and that they continue to be the best hypothesis to explain the data as observed. Hence, evolution by natural selection is now a theory in the standard lexicon. But that is not because all of us have decided to worship. It is because it is the one that has withstood attempts to falsify it most effectively and has also provided us with the greatest explanatory powers to understand and predict how the biological world might be working. Again, in closing this portion, no, I haven't quite got to the closure, so I won't say that. Again, let me remark that belief knowledge facts and research knowledge facts have equal standing within human existence. That there's not, you know, one is better than the other. It depends on the particular circumstances in which you are applying. Now, in terms of human history, belief knowledge is certainly the more primitive, the plesiomorphic for any of the biologists amongst you, of the two knowledge systems. It is inherent in almost all primitive cultures. What is amusing and makes a fascinating question is where we go with the rest of this talk is research knowledge, on the other hand, is apparently, or anything that we know at the present day, developed most effectively within Western Europe from approximately 1500 through the present day. That it has been geographically localized. Certainly, there are people, you could go out and buy all sorts of books that have two words in their title, Greeks and science. And there are an enormous number of people who contend that, hey, science started with the Greeks. And I would certainly agree that Greeks gave us rational thinking. They gave us some very basic ideas of science. But for whatever reason, the Greeks never developed a group endeavor that tested itself, that advanced itself, that created this continual sort of changing mode of knowledge. I like to describe science as a great big spiral. It keeps treading over the same ground and often the same facts, but each time it goes around, it advances a little bit because it's tested it, it's seen the information from a slightly different light. That kind of use of science as a way of knowing, I suspect many Greeks would have been comfortable to step into, but they didn't invent that particular approach. We do not have an explosion of science arising out of the Greek city-states. Rather, when we see that explosion of science, it is something that is Western European within the last roughly 300 years. Indeed, even the word science simply means to know, ordered knowledge. I'm not sure, again, Michael may catch me out on this one, but going to the Oxford English Dictionary is presumably one of the better sources of such information. The claim for the oldest use of science, a definition is, time for bifocals, but never mind, a branch of study which is concerned either with connected body of demonstrated truths or with observed facts systematically classified and more or less colligated by being brought under general laws and which includes trustworthy methods for the discovery of new truth within its own domain, 1725. Perhaps the concept of science, indeed I think it is a little older than that, but science in the classic sense just simply meant knowledge, the art of knowing, the control of an ordered body of knowledge. Science as we think of it, that is, natural and physical science is restricted to those branches of study that relate to the phenomena of the material universe and their laws, which is the OED definition, says that the OED says the first time that use of science was used was by one W.G. Ward in 1867. Science in the sense which Englishmen so commonly give to it as expressing physical and experimental science to the exclusion of the theological and metaphysical. So science has evolved through time, and has become what we now consider in the present day, starting off with collected, ordered knowledge and ultimately focusing down on collected, ordered knowledge that is specifically about the natural world, which may be tested, which may be falsified. So, how do we get there? Yeah, now I'm in the second part of the lecture. Let us look now at this tradition, which is more of a historical story of the interaction of thinking about the natural world and thinking about theology in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Again, by as much of this, I am a second-hand reporter. I am not a researcher. For those who are interested in this, I strongly suggest a little book from the University of Chicago Press by Stephen Shapin, S-H-A-P-I-N. You can ask me again later, Steve Shapin, called The Scientific Revolution. Don't do a search on The Scientific Revolution. You get about 500 titles. Do a search on Shapin, because that's a common statement. So I'm, in a sense, just being a funnel through which others, the information of others is here passed. So why should science as a group endeavor arise within the Judeo-Christian tradition in Western Europe in particular? A series of reasons. Series of features that probably all together help to force this, that no one of them is the basic source. First, Christian time, unlike most of the major religions, Christians see time as linear. There is a beginning, there is a middle, there is an end. If there is linearity, there is therefore a certain kind of order in the history of events. We're not dealing with, you know, time goes around in cycles or time is immaterial, which are common precepts in other major religions. Time being linear, you can identify where you are in a particular time because you know that everything in that history is unique. It also gives you, as it were, a goal towards which you're heading and a starting point from which you came. So, one, Christian time is linear. Two, the Christian God is rational. We're not dealing with a partying pantheon or a bunch of gods or single God that are in essence humans elevated with all of their bad traits as well as their good traits up to some kind of theistic existence. We are dealing with a particular kind of organism that is supposed to be a rational God that is also the rational creator of the entire planet, of the universe. Now that means that if you've got a rational creator, quite logically, the creation itself will also be rational. Further, that creation becomes something that you can study to better know the God who created it. And if you are a good, rational human being yourself, you are guaranteed of success in understanding that natural world, because God was rational and God made it rationally. So you're not going to run into any trouble. And if you do run into trouble, it's your fault because somehow or other you're fallible and you didn't get it right. But ultimately, because it's a rational God, the word itself will be rational. The world itself will be rational. So this leads to the whole study of natural history and natural philosophy, studying the world and the natural world to better know God. This is a little bit late in the sequence of events, but a quote from Thomas Paine, "Natural philosophy, mathematical and mechanical science, are a continual source of tranquil pleasure. And in spite of the gloomy dogmas of priests and superstition, the study of these things is the true theology. It teaches man to know and to admire the Creator. For the principles of science are in the creation and of unchangeable and divine origin." It therefore becomes a process of, as it were, worship to look at the natural world in some form because you get a better sense of the God who made it. There are other features that play in on this in addition, which I might call some ancillary points. The Christian tradition of self-doubt. That immediately sets one up to the skepticism of the science. Of course, not all Christians are self-doubting, but there's a principle there. So too, worship in groups. Many religions you worship individually, other religions you worship in groups. The fact that group endeavor is already ingrained in the Christian tradition helps. There is a tradition of debate, particularly borrowing from the Judaic history, but also arising from the Protestant schism that is taking place during the time when science is arising. People are battling back and forth each other, arguing about the nature of the Bible. Why not also argue about the nature of the world in which we live? There's some other sort of interesting little features that come in, and there are several books. I mean, everybody, humans tend to sort of focus on one-cause solutions in many cases. And so there are other books out there, one which suggests that one of the reasons why science arose in Europe when it did was the occasion of the Black Plague. Because the Black Plague is a very funny kind of disease. It goes through and it takes out a whole bunch of consumers, but it leaves the consumables behind. So if you wipe out a substantial portion of the population of Europe, you do not wipe out the infrastructure at the same time. You've got a smaller population with a bigger infrastructure, creating more free time, more food, etc., a little bit more time to go out and think about the world instead of fight off the wolves. Another person has suggested, and I will not take this one to great lengths, that the whole system of the concept of a fact in English law, arguing about facts, would have played into the process of science. So too, yet another scientist, actually Shapin again, has argued that the majority of practitioners of what we would call science in retrospect in its early days were generally gentlemen, men of money and often nobility, and they brought with them the chivalrous code of honor out of the ages of the knights, where you were supposed to tell true and you were supposed to say exactly what you observed. So in some sense, truth and honesty might have entered in this way. And I would add to this also that given that science gives us insights that allows us to use to create mechanics that allows us to make money, don't discount greed. So there are a variety of reasons that has been argued that would have favored the growth of science within Western Europe during the Middle Ages and on into the Enlightenment. One could argue that science, and many people have, was also stirring in other portions of the world. And I'm not going to treat with that this evening. I am simply going to say that of all the places organized inquiry into the nature of the natural world was stirring, it was Western Europe where it came to fruition and gave us the scientific process we have in the present day. What kind of context did that take place in? Well, there's another feature which is not uniquely Western European, but pretty close to in its design, and that's the university, the institution that is hosting this entire undertaking and to which many of you belong in one form or another. The university is a rather interesting kind of structure because just by its very name, this is not a technological institute, this is a university. It is about the universe and the universal. And the university as it is formed is a place where you learn about God's universe and the universality that is God. In the earlier universe, and by the way, why do you think we parade around in those penguin suits and with brightly colored hoods and so on at graduation time? All we're doing is reflecting the origins of the university and the university tradition in the Christian and particularly Catholic backgrounds and then ultimately Protestant backgrounds of the church. We are simply putting on our churchly gowns for graduation in memory of where we came from. Unfortunately, most of the American universities have a Protestant background, so they wear black gowns that are not particularly sprightly. But on the other hand, if you ever see some of the gowns of the Catholic universities in Europe, talk about a bunch of tropical birds. The plumage is amazing. But we come through the university. And within the university, certainly theology is a part of the undertaking, the trivium and the quadrivium. The quadrivium itself is one of the classic sets of concepts of things the students learned, including geometry and astronomy. Already there are certain aspects of the natural world creeping in. And as time went on, the university started to pick up other people that we would look at and we would talk about them as being, in some sense, scientists, botanists, for example. Good things, botanists. Yeah, good things, botanists. Most of those early botanists were actually talking about medicinal plants and medicine. But they were still within the university, and while they were talking about medicinal plants and medicine, they were also studying God's creation and advancing the cause of God's creation within that context. From that, we came to recognize the study of natural history, a term that is still very much with us. And arising from that, natural philosophy, a term that is no longer particularly with us, although I do know of one professor of natural philosophy on the eastern coast, which is taking the observations from natural history and placing them in some kind of causal framework, working out a hypothesis. And then there is the field of natural theology. And natural theology is using the data of natural history and natural philosophy to advance the knowledge of God, to figure out the nature of the attributes of God from the study of nature. And, okay, that sounds like a nice little Teutonic separation, and indeed I think it is just that, a Teutonic separation, because these things are often greatly mixed together and egg-beatered in any individual scientist background during this time. So, within the university and within the churches, we start to first make observations, and then fit those observations into larger natural philosophical precepts. And there were a couple of precepts that were kicking around that worked very well and for all intents and purposes were the initial hypotheses of natural science concerning the living world. By the way, I am in my emphasis here because of Dr. Ruse's focus on Darwin and evolution. My examples will be sort of creeping in that same direction to complement his talk. I could talk about other aspects of natural science as well. I shall show a decidedly biological turn here. One of the first hypotheses that was out there was the idea of the scala naturi, the great chain of being. This is a theological concept that ordered all of creation from the most simple-minded crystal down here up through the smallest of animals, through the more complex animals, up, of course, to man. And then, of course, as we work our way up, you know, there are different kinds of men, and white European males were at the higher end of that, and white European males who happened to be nobility were at the next step up, and white European males who were the king were the top step, and theoretically, the divine right of kings, in part, stemmed from the great chain of being, because the king stood as the turning point between that of the earth and that of heavens, and we probably went up through a whole bunch of, you know, seraphim and cherubim, and finally at the top end was God. Don't fool yourself. This is really a hypothesis to order nature. This is a scientific hypothesis within a religious background. A second hypothesis that was out there that was frequently used was the principle of plenitude. And again, we have a rational and logical God. The principle of plenitude simply says that all that ever was created and is stable. All that ever was is. That everything was created at once. It's all stable. It doesn't change. And nothing goes extinct. It's all out there. And so, therefore, the principle of plenitude said that the great scale of the great chain of being was a stable structure, which is why it was really going against religion to think about regicide. Very handy. It would get you brainwash the population this way. Now, we tend to look back at these kinds of ideas, and we tend to smile at them and think, you know, okay, a little simple-minded. But, you know, these are perfectly viable hypotheses that will help explain how the world works and interpret the world. By example, we think dinosaurs are something that we recognize in the present day. Well, all right, dinosaurs go back to the 1840s in their first determination as dinosaurs. But if you go back much earlier, dinosaur bones were discovered in the 1600s and recognized as the remains of living organisms. Okay, the folks who collected those dinosaur bones also recognized there was nothing this big around here, and this is a lot bigger than an elephant. But God, through the principle of plenitude, guarantees that nothing has gone extinct. Okay, there's a real simple solution to that, and it's something that we would normally laugh at. And that is, you turn around and you look at all those maps with the sea monsters on them. We tended to think that sea monsters were aspects, or the present day we think of sea monsters as being aspects of superstition. No, they were real fact. We got the bone right here. The animal doesn't grow anywhere around the seas of Europe. Therefore, if we sail far enough, we're going to run into the sea monster that produced that bone. That's a perfectly good hypothesis, tested, and the test of the hypothesis is suggested by sail far enough and you're going to meet a sea monster and it's going to be ugly. So these are sort of the starting points for this debate. As society becomes increasingly more fluid and free time develops, we start to see that the study of nature begins to move out of the universities and become more general. In 1662, a group of individuals at the university in England set up the Royal Society under the auspices of King Charles. The Royal Society was immediately copied across the continent, and all these Royal Societies sprang up. They were generally populated by individuals who were of the nobility, but not always. There were plenty of commoners in there, or people who had just enough free money to study natural history. They were interested in the study of nature for two purposes. One was greater national glory, and the other was indeed, in many cases, but not all, to study God. And they were also fascinated and taken with this kind of study that in a very real sense, I would argue that something quite akin to what happened 10 years ago with the establishment of the World Wide Web took place in Europe between about 1650 and 1700, that with all of these different people studying these questions, there became a flurry of exchanges at much more slower rates than the World Wide Web, but a flurry of exchanges back and forth as people began to exchange information, hypotheses, test ideas, work together, develop criteria for how one reports an experiment. This is the origin of plain language versus flowery language in reportage. What happened was a series of very rapid, I think, physical advances. particularly in the physical sciences, Leibniz, Descartes, Wright, Laplace, Newton, etc., a group of people came forward and pulled together information and began to put the world, as it were, into a physical order. Newton in particular, whom we turn around and the physicists invoke as sort of the great scientist. If you go back and you read Newton, he makes it extremely clear that what he is doing is he is discovering the order that God has put in the world. That is his purpose. That is what he is up to. He is God's spokesperson in a very strong sense. And none of these people denied God's rule and God's role. But in a sense, what they did do was they began to push us away from a theistic to a deistic God. A distant God who operated by natural law. And the term natural law became more common. There we go. I'm suffering from Michael's difficulties of last night. That same bug must have been brought into this auditorium. Does this transition to a God who operates more by law than by immediate action have any real influence upon God's standing? I give you a quote from this gentleman, Chevalier de Maillet, 1748. What comparison could we make between a clockmaker who had enough skill to make a clock so curiously that by the disorder which time should produce in its parts and its movements, there should be new springs and wheels formed out of the pieces which had been worn and broken, and another artist of the same profession whose work should, every day, every hour, every minute, require his attention to rectify its errors and eternal variations? Dumas is simply echoing this sense that what humans are starting to do is, through the study of the natural world, find out how God runs the natural world, even as we are, in a sense, beginning to, through the processes of what we would in retrospect call science, as we are beginning to understand that world on our own. The success of physical sciences, which were really wonderful, spurred other fields. Now, the physical sciences, in some senses, studying planetary motions, etc., you had the potential, because of the chance of addressing that first, you had the chance to see a system that could be described with relative precision and that worked like relative clockwork. What are the poor biologists and other folks doing in this same time frame? They certainly took the lead in both in biology, both looking at mechanistic and systematic approaches of seeking similar kinds of natural laws. In the mechanistic approaches, we see people like Harvey or Tyson who are seriously trying to make organisms out to be mechanical devices, much like de Maillet's clocks. Some of the findings are very interesting. Tyson, for example, in 1699, clearly notes the similarity in the bone structure between the chimpanzees and man. He has no problem seeing the beginning of the pattern growing there. John Ray, looking at the particular perspectives of the plant, noted several things that sound very modern in respect. That he noted that organisms were linked by reproduction, and he noted that organisms existed in the context of adaptations. But he also observed, because he was still a product of his times, that the principle of plenitude held and that these things were stable, and that the adaptations he saw as evidence of design, and as Dr. Ruse said yesterday, that evidence for design is something that is not only still with us, but certainly had a very strong influence on Charles Darwin. Now, one of the things that goes hand in hand with this process is that at the same time people are beginning to seriously look at the natural world using a research knowledge protocol and developing that protocol through time, a second fascinating aspect is going on, which again may be another bias as to why Europe. And that is, Europe invented the square-rigged ship. It stole the compass. It figured out how to use Chinese gunpowder and a gun, and it put those bits and pieces together, and they made one of the most effective explorational devices, the European square-rigged ship, that had ever come along for people moving out and spreading over the globe. Not simply a good sailing ship, but a ship that could defend and defeat others. And so at the same time, what we see is an enormous burst of exploration. Now, certainly, a lot of that exploration was forced along by greed and commerce and the urge to acquire. But a good deal of that exploration also included people who wished to acquire knowledge of God's creations. And so we see a tremendous explosion at this same time of information about the natural world. This actually causes some problems, but for the moment, let's stop for just a minute and look at some of the individuals, because I think this is, again, where religion and science intersect. We go, for example, to this individual, and again, I'm having trouble focusing here, so if you would be so kind as to do a little focus up there. Maria Marianne. Maria Marianne was a lady for whom I think there ought to be a novel written someday, sort of in the sense of an Irving Stone biographical novel. She was a Dutch businesswoman who, after her husband's death, sailed to the Dutch Guianas and spent 2 years in which she did research entirely on the life cycles of moths and butterflies. And this is one of her many drawings. She is recognized as an astute observer, right down to the point of having complete life cycles in her drawings, because here on this pineapple you can see there's the pupa, there's the caterpillar, there are the butterflies that are involved, all of whom, and the caterpillar feeds upon the pineapple. So she's showing the host plant and the complete life cycle. This is very good biology, and she didn't do it once. She did it a number of times. And she makes it very clear that she sees this as a way of worshiping God. There are others who go out to figure out God's creation who are slightly less lucky. De La Condamine was a French geographer who went out with a very substantial party of individuals. It took them 9 years to finish surveying across South America in an attempt to determine the nature of latitude and of longitude. And she, unfortunately, a substantial number of people never made it back. Then there's one which I like to hold up as the botanical Job. This is Georg Eberhard Rumpf, otherwise known in his Latin name of Rumpfius, who was a student of the plants of the Dutch East Indies, operative at the end of the 1600s. And in his studies to better know the plants and better know his God thereby, he started the project in 1662. He went blind in 1670, as indicated here. His wife and his daughter then helped him carry the project on. In 1677, an earthquake leveled his house and killed his wife and daughter. He carried on with native assistance. In 1687, a major fire burned down the entire collection, all of his illustrations, and his manuscript. By 1690, he had recreated the illustrations in the manuscript and, with native help, recollected the plants. And he sent back this description of the flora of the Dutch East Indies on a Dutch frigate, which was unfortunately sunk by a French frigate on the way home. He sat down and recreated the whole thing yet again. This time he had the sense to mail it home in separate packets and separate frigates. It actually did arrive intact, but he died before it was fully assembled and published. And we ain't done yet. In 1730, his grave was destroyed by gold-seeking sailors from the English Navy. After the English made up to the Dutch, they rebuilt the grave, and in 1942, a Japanese bomb demolished the whole area. Okay. My point on this one is that scientific data that we freely breathe and use, and which we do not think very much about the gathering of in the present day, the scientific data that were gathered originally cost people a very great deal and sometimes their lives. But there was a strong drawing force here. Some of these people were true scientists. They just wanted to know. Others of these people were driven to this because of their extreme enthusiasm and interest in religion, in God. One of the people who sat at the center of this was Carl von Linné. Actually, he was the queen spider. He sat back. He had as far away as he went ever was Lapland. That was sort of in his own backyard. He sat at home and he sent his collectors out around the world. And the classic Linnaean thesis consisted of, he would get a student and tell the student to go here, go there, collect, send it back to me. Some of the students came back, some didn't. The collections came back, Linnaeus wrote them up, and then he turned around and he handed up over the write-up to the student and said, okay, you go defend it. Don't you, any graduate students here, don't you wish your major professor to write your thesis and then you can defend it? Well, okay. Linnaeus was an extraordinary gentleman, self-styled God's registrar, trying to put all of this information together. And of course, in his tripartite structure, the Systema Naturae divided in three parts, he dealt with minerals, vegetables, and animals. Here was a man who was in the best sense of all to appreciate the order that God had placed upon earth. As he started off, he began with the European flora, and things were fairly stable. But as he and others began to be overwhelmed by the immensity of material coming in from around the world, he began to see problems. Linnaeus, at one point, though never publishing this, found only in his own letters, ultimately came to describe species as the children of time. He recognized that things were changing, even his own experiments. And in some senses, it's one of the great aspects of fate that Linnaeus, who was God's registrar, died ultimately as a man who, after a stroke, couldn't even remember his own name. So the confusion arose, and Linnaeus was not the first to see it. This immense amount of information that was coming in began to show that the great chain of being, the Scala Naturae, had so many shoots zigging off in different directions that it was very difficult to fit all of this information. If you're just looking at the European flora and fauna, which is relatively depauperate after the last glaciation, it works. You may have to sort of, you know, push a few things into corners, but when you start exploring the tropics, all hell breaks loose. So too, as the explorers spread out around the world, the principle of plenitude comes in under increasing attack, because ultimately, hey, we're not seeing those sea monsters, but we're still seeing those fossils. Where are they? Linnaeus is not alone. Others begin to play with what's happening, what's going on in the natural world. Buffon attempted to write a description of the natural history of all of the animals that Linnaeus cataloged. And Buffon, in so doing, ultimately came up, he said, things change. They've got to be changing. He came up with words in his description that would be very familiar to a modern evolutionary biologist. He spoke about competition. He spoke about variation. He spoke about the importance of geography. He spoke about extinction. But he couldn't escape his time to come up with a hypothesis to hang these things together to make it work. But the ideas are out there. People are beginning to think about this with great care. Buffon was decidedly, I think, out on the margins in talking publicly about this as a scientific hypothesis. But the amusing thing is that lots of other people are talking about this too. And if they're feeling slightly chicken about it, they can do it by writing fiction. And so Desmarais, of the earlier clockmaker quote, has a long fictional trip that he writes up under a very bad pseudonym, in which he starts to hypothesize about the origin of the earth, the origin of life, and the evolution of life, concluding at one point that man is but a species of ape, more perfect than those who do not speak. The ideas are getting out there. We're in the middle 1700s. And they're common enough that they even provide fodder for satirization, because if you turn around and you read Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, Jonathan Swift is having a heyday not only with social conditions in Europe, he is also having a heyday with all the exploration that's going on and all the screwball scientific hypotheses that are popping up out of it. I would be remiss not to briefly mention this gentleman, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who has a really bum rap in most science courses for being the inventing the idea of the communication of characteristics by the process inheritance of acquired characteristics, you know, the giraffe stretching its neck longer and longer. Lamarck had actually assembled a very elegant, perhaps I might say typically French, logical evolutionary system to explain all this new information that was coming in, of which the inheritance of acquired characters is but a tiny portion. But he was working on, you know, we think of him again to make fun of him, he was trying again, like Buffon, like other individuals, to fight out how to put all of this together and to look for an aspect of natural law that would explain this diversity that is coming in. And the two-bit word that fits into this is a lovely noise, transmutation. The going word by the end of the 1700s and the beginning of the 1800s is this question of transmutation, of how does God's law create this diversity, because it is clear that things are not particularly stable. It is clear things go extinct, and it's pretty clear things come into existence. I'm going to turn here from looking at the biological side, and I'm going to move over to the Earth history just briefly. Come on, I got to do something for paleontology and geology. The inherited sum of Earth history, as it was understood in sort of the same sense as the great chain of being and the principle of plenitude, the last word came from this gentleman, the Bishop Usher, who concluded after exhaustive study of Scripture that the world was created on the night before October 23rd, 404 B.C., and this was, in essence, a way of looking at Earth history. But there are other people who were beginning in the study of the Earth to establish the fact that there were other ways of looking at Earth history. The idea of superposition that arose in the middle 1600s, suggesting that, you know, it's very simple. And the idea of superposition is about gravity, and it simply says you cannot lay this rock down. Excuse me, let's try that again. You cannot lay this rock down until the other one is in place underneath it. That if two things are stacked upon each other, there has to be a temporal sequence. The one that's underneath got there first, the one that's there got there second. Okay, fine. If you tip them all upside down, maybe that's not true, but generally rock deformation can be determined. And if two rocks occur in a stack, the bottom one is older. We're talking gravity here. We're actually talking gravity as it was described 50 years before Newton came up with the concept. But the idea of superposition. This began to give people a view, as it were, thinking about the passage of time in the history of Earth. And I skip a lot here, but this gentleman is perhaps a turning point in the whole process. This is James Hutton, a Scots philosopher, a part of the Scots Enlightenment, and a farmer in Scotland, who very specifically went out to try to figure out how soil was made, because he recognized that soil was something that a provident God gave one to make a good farm on. He, in this process, came up with two great insights. The first was what we, in retrospect, teach all of our little undergraduates, the principle of the present is the key to the past, uniformitarianism. His statement, in examining things present, we have data from which to reason with regard to what has been. That we can look at ongoing processes at the present day, measure them, count them, and then infer those same occurrences in the past and make an inference about what the past was like. He did so, and he watched the erosion and the rates of erosion from the Scots Highlands, the rates of transport of soil down through the rivers to the ocean, the rates of burial. He understood that somehow you then had to lift those sediments up again to remake them and make them back into mountains. In part, one of his great contributions geologically was to recognize this unconformity, where you see a series of rocks standing on end underneath and another series of rocks lying atop them at a high angle. He realized that both of these sets of rocks being made up of sediments, that is, things that were once mud, that the time had to have passed for this set to have been eroded and laid down, turned into rock, tilted vertically, buried beneath the ocean, then another set of rocks laid down on top of it, turned into rock, the whole thing tilted and uplifted. Without having numbers to put on this, but he did come to the conclusion, looking at the rates that he got from erosion and transport, no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end. He opened an immense trapdoor of time. Unfortunately, he opened that trapdoor and that insight just as Napoleon started to roam over the European continent. And with times of political instability come times of theological conservatism, because we all had to rally around the flag boys. So this idea, first generated in the 1790s, virtually disappeared until after we gotten rid of Napoleon and stuffed him away on St. Helena and then poisoned him or whatever we did to him. And it's not until Napoleon is safely in his grave that this idea comes back out in the time of Pax Britannica, when Britain ruled, and we could, you know, there's enough room in the system, we can go back and consider some rather challenging ideas. And it was brought back to life by this gentleman, who those who were present last night have already met, Sir Charles Lyell. Again, if you can try a little focus, please. Try? Oh, well. So Charles Lyell is a lawyer by training, but independently wealthy enough that he can go and do what he wants, and he becomes fascinated with geology, and he rediscovers Hutton. And the end result is that Charles Lyell sits down and takes Hutton, takes Hutton's observations and insights, and writes a three-volume treatise of geology, pretty much codifies geology, but he codifies it around this idea of uniformitarianism, of a mechanism of reasoning. It is at this point, where are we in the system? At this point, transmutation. There's an enormous amount of information that has come in. It has been gathered, as I say, largely underneath a theological cloak, though many of the people were also purely scientists. I mean, I can take you back and show you some people who were, good heavens, did they have atheists back then? Yeah, they did, who were just out there doing natural history because they love natural history. But a large amount of information is coming in from people who are studying to better know God. And as a result, we are recognizing we're looking for some kind of natural law, transmutation. extinction is recognized as real. Time is recognized as long. And it's at this point, and I apologize, my slide is darker than the much better one that Michael had last night. It's at this point that the gentleman steps in on this slide, Charles Darwin. Charles is brought into this entire system as, for all intents and purposes, a young student in theology. As mentioned, as a gentleman of the middle classes, he was initially sent off to do a doctoral degree in Edinburgh, and after he ran sick out of the operating theater, remember they didn't have any form of sedatives at that point, he went back home and said, no way, I'm not doing that. The other alternatives were to join the military, if you were a gentleman of those times, to join the military, or to go to the bar. Neither of those turned him on, so he got sent off to the State Theological Seminary, a.k.a. Cambridge. And yes, Cambridge University at that point is, for all intents and purposes, an Anglican theological seminary. And remember the university. The university is where those individuals who are studying aspects of the natural world and God congregated. He was quite like many undergraduates we are familiar with, a quote from his father, "You care for nothing but shooting dogs and rat catching, and you will be a disgrace to your family." Well, he caught rats with the absolute best of them. And he studied with some of the foremost natural philosophers of the day, learned his plants, learned his geology, learned his insects, and learned his Anglican theology. He hopped onto the Beagle, as described before, so I'm covering previous ground here, and was struck by a variety of things, geology in South America, but particularly when he reached the Galapagos Islands, he was struck very much by the different biota on each of the different islands. We tend to focus today on Darwin's finches, but again, as Michael said last evening, it was the tortoises that first caught his eye, because the different tortoises on the different islands were different. And one of the features that is being discussed at the time when he was sailing was the role of geography. Buffon's idea of the influence of geography on species making was out and about, and the light bulb went on. Now, again, as indicated last evening, but here I have to owe my deep thanks to Professor Ruse for finally making sense of this one. When Darwin left, he took with him a book by the Reverend Paley. And the Reverend Paley argued for intelligent design. That is, that all of the designfulness of the world reflected the intelligence of the deity who was behind it, and the care and the planning of that intelligent deity. He also, Charles, took along Lyell, and he read both of them. And as pointed out, what he really did on that voyage was not reject Paley, but put Paley into the context of a mechanistic solution using, in many respects, Lyell's insights to geology and applying them to biology. And he came back out the other end of that, and certainly by the end of the 1830s, evolution by natural selection was firmly in his mind. It is interesting, he did not actually publish earlier, and I suggest the reason that he did not. Matter of fact, I don't suggest. The reason he did not is fairly clearly that in 1844, this gentleman published what amounted to biological hypothesis of transmutation. And this is Robert Chambers. It was not in any sense backed up with the kind of science that Darwin had done, the research that Darwin had done. But it put out the ideas of transmutation on a scientific basis. But it did so in the time of socialist uprisings in much of the continent. And in a very real sense, what Chambers did was stuck a toe into the water for evolution and got it shot off. And Darwin, you know, sort of looked around as a respectable gentleman. By the way, Chambers wrote this book as an anonymous book, so that it took a long time to pin it back on him. Even Chambers probably had his doubts. But Darwin is a member of the respectable middle class. I don't think I want to go there. And in truth, evolution, there's an argument that evolution by natural selection would not have been published by Darwin had not Alfred Russel Wallace in 1858 come to exactly the same mechanistic conclusion. But to come back on this one, all the way down to Charles Darwin, we are dealing with something, and even in Darwin, that is operating inside of a theological basis, that we are studying the mechanisms by which God works on the earth, the laws. Of course, thereafter, things go to hell. We end up with this distinction between religion and science, and particularly the question of evolution. And as Dr. Ruse said last night, A good deal of this we can perhaps lay at the feet of this gentleman, Thomas Henry Huxley, who proceeded to use the evolution by natural selection, a scientific hypothesis, as a mechanism to forward his general social ideas for what should happen in England in the Industrial Revolution. And you know, it is not just Thomas Henry Huxley who has then turned around and used science, as it were, to advance a non-scientific cause. And in conclusion, I would say we've not learned a lot from Huxley. On the other hand, the first time I heard this last night was indeed Michael's exposition of it, and it makes excellent sense. Maybe that story needs to be told more loudly. But we still continue to make similar kinds of mistakes of using scientific conclusions in the present day to support our particular political viewpoints. Scientists have got to be more careful and separate themselves from that. In addition to that, a lot of scientists have decided that science now replaces religion. They have gotten themselves into science, they're doing natural studies, and they have decided that somehow or other, if you are a scientist, you can now dismiss the existence of a God. Indeed, one of the classic routines is that if you are a scientist, you are probably an atheist. I see no reason for that necessarily being so, and I would point out that to be an atheist is as much to be a believer as to believe in a God, because either you believe in or you believe that you're not going to believe in, but you're still believing. The only place you really belong if you're a scientist and you want to push the science into your general life is an agnostic. I don't know. Probability comes back again. But many scientists have not gone and thought this one out carefully, and many of them see quite seriously religion and science as directly opposed. There is no reason for this. I see no basis for this in the two separate ways of knowing. They are different ways of knowing. They give us different things, but they are not necessarily opposed. There's another aspect where scientists make frequent error, and that is they mistake precision for truth. And there are a lot of scientists, again, as I started out at the beginning of this lecture, who believe in truth, that they have an answer. I suggest that those individuals go back and think about it very carefully, and they be very careful when they talk to the public, because if you have a scientific truth, then somebody can argue against you with a religious truth, and your scientific truth has no way of being compared to that religious truth, and who's right? Well, maybe the guy who weighs more. But it causes an unnecessary kind of conflict. The greatest danger that I see here, and what I sincerely hope that this kind of an interaction is sponsored by the Templeton Foundation will achieve, is that science learns where its margins are and how far it can go, and that science is careful to separate itself from belief knowledge and never be guided by belief knowledge, and that those people who are scientists, if they are going to use their science to some cause, separate the science and the doing of it from the pursuit of that cause very clearly. So too, I suggest, though I know some of the other Templeton lecturers might disagree with this, that it is inappropriate to try to test religion in a scientific manner. I think that is a different kettle of fish. It answers a different portion of the human nature and a different portion of the human need, and I think that in that sense, it is in some respects doing a disservice to the purposes of religion and human existence to try to treat it in a scientific manner. Thank you.
Now, where is our Professor Roos, by the way?
Sleep back there.
Ah, okay, you're up now. Now, you've been such an agreeer with Bruce through the last several evenings, and this little quibble around probabilities, I'm sure you've admitted the error of your ways, but if you have any reason to come up, now's your chance, and then after Professor Roos, we shall feature our Professor Porter Abbott. Oh, yes, and Brendan will be walking around. If you've thought of questions, please hand them to the aisles.
Well, as you heard, Bruce Stephanie's, he's won teaching awards, and one can see why. And he's such a nice chap. And he's so engaging, and he's so warm and friendly. One feels, you know, an absolute rat for taking umbrage at anything that he says. However, I am of the rodent strain, and since I'm being paid so much money, I feel that from Sir John Templeton, I feel that I have a moral obligation to say something at least, you know, quasi-critical. So in the understanding that all of my comments are to be taken in that spirit, let me show my Christian background by making three comments. The first is, I think there was a very interesting comment that Bruce made at the beginning about science being a better way of knowing God. And, you know, one can certainly see a PhD thesis being written on this. I mean, it's an interesting, a really interesting comment. It's one of those things which has a terrific amount of truth in, even though it's completely and utterly false. Let me raise two or three issues more for discussion than for absolute, you know, going against what he says, which lead me to worry about that. First of all, the Greeks. Now, you probably noticed that Bruce introduced the Greeks at the beginning of his talk, and then halfway through he took some time out to put the boot into them by saying they weren't the kind of scientists who would get a PhD on this campus. However, for all that, speaking as a philosopher, I'm going to speak in defense of the Greeks, and I wonder whether it's truly... one can truly say that the Greeks, who surely were doing science, even if it wasn't good enough science to get in the journals that Bruce publishes in, but nevertheless, the Greeks surely were doing science, and I think that it's a very tenuous claim to say that the Greeks were doing this better to know God. Certainly, when one thinks of the sort of work that Aristotle was doing, and Aristotle was as good a biologist as he was good as a philosopher, and I mean that as high praise, and yet we know that Aristotle's concept of God was about a divine being who had no interest in us because he was so perfect he spent all of his time contemplating his own perfection, a little bit like some of my previous girlfriends. But certainly... one wonders whether or not Aristotle thought that he was doing science so that he should better know God. And I'm not sure that I would want to say that. Secondly, I wonder, whilst obviously there is much to do with the God issue, and certainly since Sir John Templeton is paying for what we're doing, we should mention it tonight. Nevertheless, I do think that one should raise the issue of technology. Bruce did bring it up about sailing ships and these sorts of things, but I think an awful lot of science which was going on after the scientific revolution was as much for technological value as it was for any theological value. So without saying that what Bruce was saying was wrong, I think that probably it's very incomplete, and one should certainly raise a lot of the technological issues. I mean, Galileo doing work on mechanics, which would have, you know, issues to do with cannonballs and all of those sorts of things. So I think that that's certainly an issue which needs raising. And the third thing that I would certainly want to raise, and I don't think Bruce would disagree with me here, but I think it should be mentioned, is, of course, Christians come in many different stripes, and particularly they come in Catholic and Protestant, certainly in the West. And I think that any analysis of the relationship between religion and science should certainly take this into consideration. Again, I'm not criticizing Bruce for what he did, but suggesting that there's more work to be done here. And certainly, whilst, particularly in the light of Thomistic philosophy, one could certainly say that, given Aristotle's thinking about analogy, that science is a way of better knowing God, I'm not sure that that's directly transferable into Protestant thought. Certainly, when one thinks of people like Luther, and Calvin also, and their very ambiguous relationship to natural theology, whether or not they would have thought that science was a way of better knowing God. Probably this is true for Anglicans, but of course don't forget that Anglicans are a very peculiar kind of Christians who, of course, took over a great deal of Catholic, not only Catholic ways of doing things, but Catholic thought. So certainly I think this is probably true of Anglicans, but whether it's true of the others, I'm not sure at all. Certainly, a number of people have related science and Puritanism, which obviously goes back to Calvinism. But whether this is a better way of knowing God or a better way of knowing God's creation, I think are two different things, and I don't think that that's entirely a trivial distinction. So these are not so much criticisms of what Bruce said, but I think that these would be things that one would, as it were, need to take up in a whole semester's study. There are many other things that I could take umbrage with what Bruce said, but since others are going to talk and since we want to get into discussion, let me just simply say what I said yesterday, and I'll say again today, is I think doing a little bit of philosophy is an awfully bad thing for scientists. And I think that Bruce shows this. He's obviously a decent human being. I'm sure he's a good scientist. But frankly, folks, he's a pretty crappy philosopher. I'm speaking in a technical sense here. In particular, that he should have read that dreadful little man Karl Popper and taken him seriously only goes to show this. I mean, it's absolute nonsense. It's absolute nonsense to think that science cannot find the truth. Anybody who thinks in this day and age that the gene is not the DNA molecule and that the DNA molecule is not a double helix, you know, they not only should be stripped of their tenure, I mean, you know, they should be driven from California. I mean, you know, really and truly, I mean, that's just plain silly. Or to use my example, the example I like most of all, we've all seen, I'm sure, the movie Men in Black. Now, it is, of course, logically possible. I'm not denying that it is logically possible that Bruce, nice chappy sitting there, is in fact an alien. And that when he gets into the car tonight, on the back seat of the car, suddenly his belly is going to start pushing like this, and out is going to pop a little, you know, what shall we say, Jim Proctor. I mean, it's possible. It is logically possible. But all I can say is that anybody who truly thinks that in any sense that is probable, let alone certain, that is not a total and complete falsehood, as I say, has been reading altogether too much philosophy. So what I want to say is, I want to say, it's one of those things. We all get up and we want to be, you know, oh yes, I'm all in favor of women's liberation. I respect women just like, you know. And we all know that we're talking absolute nonsense because it's politically correct, because, you know, the dean will jump on us if this happens, or we won't get our paycheck at the end of the day. But truly, when we get to the faculty club, but we say, but truly, folks, I just don't think that was true. And frankly, I just don't think that it's true that science is only probable. And, you know, perfectly honest, I think you've got a couple of drinks into Bruce, he would admit that it isn't true either. That there are some things that he knows, and I know, and he knows that I know, and he knows that he knows. And he even knows that God knows.
No, I don't. I'm an agnostic.
Well, I'm going to be another rodent. Though not quite as hairy. But first, let me say that I have no serious quarrel with Bruce's really excellent assessment of the way science emerged from the Judeo-Christian tradition. I think I'd modify it and call it the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition because of the enormous contributions of Islam to the efflorescence of science in the Renaissance. But I'm not going to focus on that. I want to focus on two things, two points, and I'll take about as long as Michael on this. And one is critical, and one I hope is constructive. And the first point has to do with Bruce's distinction between belief knowledge and research knowledge. And regarding research knowledge, I don't have as much difficulty as Michael. Knowledge in science is not knowledge, perhaps, of the truth, but it is certainly knowledge of very high probabilities, and I'll go along with Michael and call it the truth, regarding falsifiable contentions supported by repeated empirical tests that are in turn governed by agreed-upon protocols. That I've got no problem with that. But I have a big problem with the other kind of knowledge, belief knowledge. And it isn't relieved, I think, by putting its kind of truth in scare quotes. And I read the notes, and he's got truth in quotes in the notes. And I think that's always a way of having your cake and eating it too. And it won't work. And the reason is that to define truth as something that belongs uniquely to an individual through what neither the individual nor anyone else can know for certain is a genuine revelation. That is an actual communication from divinity or the supernatural or whatever you want to call it, is to disable the concept of truth. Such a private experience could be truth, but then again it could be delusion. There is no way of adjudicating. The individual takes it for truth, which is another way of saying that the individual believes it. But belief is a leap, the act of taking something for true in the absence of confirmation. This is the case whether it be a belief in a benevolent deity or a belief in a rescue spaceship waiting in the shadow of Comet Hale-Bopp. You'll perhaps remember that. It is a radical act that fills in a space of mystery, so the phrase belief knowledge has to be an oxymoron. It's either belief or it's knowledge. That's my view. Nor can the relation of truth and belief be saved, or be solved, by redirecting attention to the advantages of belief. Bruce may not be making this particular argument, but he draws on its rhetorical force, so let's get it clear too. If it is the case, as Bruce quite rightly maintains, that great personal strength can be a function of belief, and he's got all kinds of examples here, such a function cannot confirm the truth of the belief. Nor is it possible to take up a related gambit to measure the truth value of a belief in terms of the quality of its effects. If it is common wisdom that the great personal strength afforded by belief can act as powerfully for evil as for good, and it certainly can, you cannot infer from these good or evil effects the truth value of the beliefs that motivate them. The deeds of Sister Teresa may have been as good as those of Osama bin Laden were evil, but this distinction is not sufficient to confer truth on the beliefs of the one or untruth on the beliefs of the other, however much one may want to do it. The term truth, like the term knowledge, should not be used as an honorific, and I think in those instances it would be. My second point has to do with the issue of the relations of science and religion, and Bruce's overarching argument that an historical perspective should encourage greater mutual tolerance between the parent and the child. Now, the analogy of parents and children is a loaded one, since part of the process of growing up involves leaving the family and even at times abandoning what's called the faith of our fathers, or faith of our mothers, whatever. So here is the question. Does the growth of this particular child, science, require a similar abandonment? Indeed, an intolerance of religion with regard to questions of truth. Important qualifier. And here I would have to say, yes, it does. Insofar as we define religion as involving the commitment to a belief or set of beliefs. My qualifier is very important. As Bruce himself points out, it means, among other things, a necessary intolerance of the truth claims, not only of traditional Western religions, but of atheism as well. Skipped a paragraph. But of atheism as well, since atheism is a commitment to a belief. On the particular issue of the existence or non-existence of a God, the returns are simply not yet in, nor I imagine will they ever be, at least in this life. Here I would like to go back to Thomas Huxley, who keeps coming back, and whom Michael yesterday blamed for starting the whole dispute between evolution and Christianity by making evolution a secular religion. I think this is a bum rap. Making evolution a secular religion was the job of people like Herbert Spencer and Ernst Haeckel, and indeed many others, who conveyed the satisfactions of religion by promulgating a whole future predicated on a set of melioristic evolutionary beliefs, that things would necessarily get better. Huxley, in contrast, disseminated evolution in part to distinguish it from what he called the ethical sphere. Indeed, he set the ethical specifically in opposition to the reign of evolution. But at the same time, and here's another term that's come up, or near it, Huxley introduced another important concept and called it agnosticism, which is the acknowledgement of the condition of not knowing. It is fitting that a scientist should have come up with this term because, as Bruce points out, one of the things science constantly teaches when it is done well is how little certainty there is in our knowing, though Michael will disagree to a certain degree. I think he'll also agree there's a lot of uncertainty. Here is where I think that science can help religion, but only if we now open up the definition of religion to include an attitude that does not involve belief. but rather its opposite, the contemplation of our ignorance. The intensity of this attitude distinguishes it from garden variety agnosticism, which is often a stance of indifference. It involves a kind of metaphysical frisson, a kind of thrill. There are two questions in particular that are especially thrilling because it is more than likely that no amount of science will ever penetrate them, though, of course, I cannot say this for a certainty. One is the old chestnut that I think Leibniz was the first to formulate, or at least he formulated it. Why is there something rather than nothing? And the other, put simply, is why am I me? The longer version of the second is why is there individually specific self-consciousness? Cultivating awareness of one's ignorance requires great rigor. For to the extent that you begin to fill in these amazing blanks, to the same extent do you reduce their mystery and their excitement. It is understandable why one should want to fill them in, since certainty is one of the things we seem to crave as a species. One is free, of course, to create such belief knowledge, to put in a God in these blanks, and then to go on to attach traits to this God, giving it benevolence or malevolence, justice or injustice, mercy or cruelty, omnipotence or fallibility. But at each step, one blocks out more of the mystery. One may gain much complication and paradox in one's thinking, but these are only distractions. So here is where science and religion join hands to great effect. For science, by not allowing us to settle for any untested or untestable hypothesis, sharpens our sense of the wonderful in the old true sense of wonder. Thank you.
Well, well, not only what a talk, but what comments. You know, Porter, with comments like that, we're going to have to talk about you coming back sometime next year and getting a chance to stand up. And maybe we'll have Bruce come in as discussant for you on that occasion. He'll get even. And Michael, you know, we have to teach you to just say what you feel and don't pull your punches. These folks from these Brits, you know, they just never know where they stand. Okay, so we have a few questions. Actually, I would rate these as the best questions that have been asked so far. The problem is most of them are so long and detailed that we will see how we get to them, and if not, I'll funnel them off to Bruce, and there actually is a means technologically for him to answer them online, and we can post them, and I'll put on our email list, which some of you perhaps are on or have signed up for, an announcement. You can check the answer online. So let's give this a start. Oh, here comes one from Nancy. Chat on that, okay. We'll take that as a regular question. Here's an interesting combination of a couple comments that were made already. Your philosophy is somewhat Popperian. Could you give us an example of an observation that could refute your distinction between belief and research knowledge?
No.
A few more words.
No.
Okay, we've heard it twice.
In fairness to Bruce, dear God, that I should be fair to Bruce. Maybe I am. It is time for me to go to bed. was Bruce making a scientific statement when he said there is a distinction between these two? Popper never, ever said the only kind of knowledge is scientific knowledge. Popper perfectly was open to metaphysical knowledge and those sort of things. Notice that Popper was not a logical positivist who said that the only meaningful knowledge is scientific knowledge. What Popper was saying is there's a distinction between science and non-scientific knowledge, and the big problem is when you think that scientific or that non-scientific knowledge is scientific knowledge, like, for instance, Freud. So I think that Popper would, people often said, well, what about your own principle of falsifiability? You know, how could you falsify this? And I think Popper had a very legitimate response by saying this is a normative claim. It is not just a description, it is a normative claim, and therefore not scientific, and I don't have to falsify it. And in fairness to Bruce, I don't think that Bruce has to falsify what he's saying.
Gee, I wish I'd said that. No.
Okay, we're going to stick with belief and research knowledge just a little bit. This is a loaded question, but loaded questions are okay. Is the following statement belief knowledge or research knowledge? Quote, all genetic information in the history of life initially resulted from purely unguided random changes. The arrival of the fittest was not the result of intelligence, but rather pure chance.
Two questions there. One involves the origin of genetic material. We can test that. We can set up hypotheses. We can experiment with those hypotheses and see whether they are refuted or supported. We can develop an idea of how a genome may have evolved. We can never know whether or not that particular set of hypotheses and their tests are what really happened. We can only know that with the present technology, present understanding, that's the best understanding we can get within a naturalistic basis. The second half of the question had to do with, in essence, that everything is random. I think I remember that.
Okay,
correctly.
The arrival of the fittest was not the result of intelligence, but
the result of pure chance. But the result of pure chance. If we are dealing with a naturalistic, and this is an initial assumption of doing science, that we are dealing with the natural world, then we have to deal with the fact that we are observing things that do not have the ability to wreck themselves, that in that definition, organisms, the mutations that occur in organisms, the environments those organisms encounter with their new mutations arise at random in both cases with respect to the organism. It is unable to plan for itself, and the answer is yes. If we assume non-random control, then we are assuming that there's some feature that is not natural in our understanding that is doing this.
General? Okay, very good. You want to jump in, Porter?
I'm very much of your mind. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. Yes, absolutely. Mm.
Okay. You're getting good support now. They were so critical of you, and now they're closer in physical proximity, and you're bigger. Wasn't there this bigger thing you were mentioning in your lecture? Okay. Or fuzzy, or something you are. Okay. Isn't science just an ordered search for knowledge? And if so, aren't we all folk scientists? Cross-culturally, but only in Western cultures is there enough money to throw at it to make it official.
Okay, we come back. And I would I disagree with Michael's earlier statement about the Greeks doing science in precisely the same way that Western Europe created science. There is a logical and rational approach to gathering data that I think is universal and occurs in all societies. Call it, if you wish, folk science. However, the ordered group procedure of this, working to a common goal, erecting testing hypotheses to that as a purposeful end, is something that, for whatever reason, seems to have developed first in Western Europe, which is not to say it could not have evolved out of some other culture if time had passed and Europe had not evolved it, but it did evolve first in Europe. So that it is, I think, a fairly fine distinction that I am making, but I would make the distinction between science as that ordered body of knowledge that has gotten, that has turned our society inside out in the last 150 years, for all intents. It's running away with us at a rate which I think that humans are having difficulty coping with and dealing with. But I think that that kind of science is a distinct from the folk science that I believe the question is asking about.
Okay, thank you.
Well, don't thank him yet, just yet.
Ah. Oh, Michael. Go ahead.
I love Americans. I really, truly love Americans. But there are times when I despair of you. I mean, you know, you are so convinced that your own time and your own place is the right way of doing things, and that anything else is, you know, if it doesn't measure up or whatever, it either isn't real, it isn't right, or it doesn't exist. How any person with how many PhDs in botany have you got in your family? Can honestly say that Archimedes was not a scientist absolutely leaves me speechless, as you're noticing right now. I have nothing to say.
Let's observe you being speechless. Oh, okay, fine.
And I have got to come back. Porter will move.
Go ahead, Bruce.
Got to come back, and I did not say that Archimedes was not a scientist. I said that science in the sort of corporate sense that it has made the immense leaps and bounds of the recent past is something Archimedes did not have access to. Now, maybe back to an earlier question, if the Greek city-states had been a bit more stable and stayed stable for longer, they might have gotten there, but they didn't.
Well, of course, this little weasel word corporate came in, which makes me think of Enron. It's true that ancient Greece did not have Enron, but I do not see what relevance that has to whether or not Archimedes was a scientist.
Porter, you can see that in addition to your astute comments, we placed you in the middle for a reason here.
I'm glad I'm here.
Before I've finished, I want to get at this asshole, too. I haven't finished about Thomas Henry Huxley. Okay?
Your turn.
I didn't want to raise it, you understand.
I defend Bruce. I think that he did mention the Greeks. And he mentioned with the evolution of the Judeo-Christian tradition the gradual consolidation of a number of things that abetted what we call in the present practice science. But you weren't saying that Archimedes wasn't
not at all.
And incidentally, when you said we must mention Islam, I thought, oh my God, here we come and another liberal American. Let me apologize for what I did not say, but that I was about to say before you went on. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right to mention Islam in this context. I mean, if we say Judeo-Christian, frankly, the Judeo background was very important. I would not think that the ancient Jews had a great tradition of science. I mean, their thought came into Christianity, and that was very important.
I think the tradition of hermeneutics, though,
but certainly, unambiguously, you're absolutely right that Islam was an absolutely fundamental component of modern science, and I think it's fair to say that today's historians of science would recognize that fully.
However, in that, I spent a substantial amount of time reading on Islamic contributions to science, and I found that most certainly they are a conduit through which an enormous amount of information came to Western Europe. I remain extremely puzzled. I have some mild hypotheses, but as a biologist, geologist, mild hypotheses in history are probably not going to cut it. But I remain extremely puzzled why they did not come up with the, what I will use again just to see Michael respond, corporate approach to the group nature of science. They did not end up in Islam beating us to the punch and creating the scientific tradition, and we don't turn back to Islam when we talk about the origin of science in the modern sense.
Well, I do. Of course I turn back to the Greeks, but I would certainly include Islam in this. I mean, the work that they did in astronomy, for instance, measuring the size of the universe and working on eclipses and the distance that the Earth is from the Moon. I mean, read Thomas Kuhn's little book on the structure of the Copernican Revolution, particularly the appendices, where he gives you these measurements that these people were making. And I mean, frankly, it's PhD quality science and more.
And a lot of it was done with collaborating academics.
Right, but I come back to the question. I agree with you entirely, but we're back to Archimedes again. Not from this tradition did the enormous burst of interest and flowering and sort of overwhelming power of study of the natural world arise. Why? I agree with you entirely on your statements that these people were doing science, but in the broad sense, in science and the way that it's sort of taken over society in the present day, that we have the kind of debate between religion and science that we have in the present day.
I'm going to move to a final question, if you don't mind. This is taking it in perhaps a slightly different direction. And this is for you, Bruce.
Big thanks.
Sure. Can you look into future, taking into consideration, perhaps, that more and more scientists from different faiths, or perhaps with no faith at all, are practicing science? They find evolution and other scientific research can explain the world quite well without God. Do you think science was born out from Western religion, but can well develop on its own?
I think what that comes back to is one of the points I was trying to make in closing, that science is part of culture as a whole. If it divorces itself from that culture and tries to set itself up as an entirely independent entity without realizing its source and how that plays back into culture, I think this is a recipe for difficulty. I think that science has to pay attention to its role in culture as a whole, not just in its, as most scientists tend to, I fear, think, its own little world.
Well, Bruce Tiffany, a very final word, Porter?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, we'll leave that one for Bruce. Bruce Tiffany, Professor Michael Ruse, Professor Porter Abbott, and all of you, I'd like to thank you all for your participation tonight. I'd like to thank the John Templeton Foundation again for their sponsorship of the series, the Religious Studies Department, which co-sponsored tonight's talk, and all the support we have at UCSB. And I'd like to remind you, the series continues in April. Thursday, April 11th, Harold Oliver, The Complementarity of Science and Religion. And then Friday, April 12th, Thomas Carlson faculty here in Religious Studies, Modernity and the Mystical, Science, Technology, and the Task of Human Self-Creation. Thank you all very much. Good night.